Good morning and thank you very much for coming today. The title of my talk is Life After Hacking. But if I'm going to talk about life after hacking, first I must tell you about life before and during hacking. Actually, I don't remember much of life before hacking. My first hacking experience was when I was 14 years old. That's nearly 40 years ago. And yes, I hacked a royal. Glenn Mulcair, pah. He wasn't even born. How did this happen? We lived in a field, literally. Okay, it was a Church of England rectory, but it had a leaky roof and no heating, and all around for miles were fields. Our phone number was field 218. Really, we had to go through the operator to get our neighbour on field 217. In a place like that, there's nothing to do except for hack on ponies. I hacked my royal out hunting. That's not hacking, I hear you cry. Well, this was cubbing. In those days, out with the Mennel in Staffordshire, we wore hacking jackets for cubbing. So I say we hacked. Princess Anne was in front of me on an inexperienced young bay. We had been trained never to overtake royals in the field. But her horse stopped at this ginormous hedge and refused repeatedly to go. Out of skill and necessity, I broke the laws of the countryside. I axed protocol. I hacked past Princess Anne at a canter and led her horse over a jump. She even said thank you. My point in telling my hacking story is that sometimes it is right to break the rules. I truly don't believe that any journalists involved in hacking started out with bad intentions. I'm not sure when journalists began hacking in the sense that we understand it today, but about 10 years ago, I got one of my biggest scoops to date. I was put under immense pressure by my news desk to get the name of the next Archbishop of Canterbury before it was officially announced. So I hit the telephone. I spent hours and hours, days and days, on that phone. I sweated earwax into that phone. Tears ran down my cheeks as I tried and tried to do what I knew to be impossible. I went out and talked to people. Finally, I got a lead. Then another. Powerful people who I trusted heard that I was onto it and phoned up, pretending to reveal what they knew full well to be false information. But our sources were good. There were people who, for reasons of their own, wanted the information that it was Rowan Williams out in the public domain. But the stress. If we have a limited number of heartbeats allocated to us by God, I reckon that getting that story took 1, possibly 2 months off my life, because my heart raced so over those weeks. I can't say I enjoyed any minute or second of getting that story. In the months and years afterwards, I used to look at the news of the world, week after week, as exclusive after stunning exclusive appeared on the front. I used to think, how do they do it? I couldn't conceive of what going through what I went through with my Rowan story week after week after week. And now we know neither could they. Now we know how they did it. For all the pressure that he put me under, my news editor would have been appalled if I had broken the law to get that story. On the day that I joined the Times from the Daily Mail in 1987, the then news editor stared at me and he said in front of a crowded office, "This is the Times. We do things differently here." I knew what he was talking about. He meant no dark arts. The sense was one of overwhelming relief. "Thank you, God," I said in my head. "Not that we ever hacked on the Mail, you understand. Heaven forbid." But it did take me some months to recover from the shock of discovering that the Times Library did not possess anywhere, and believe me, I looked, the Times Library did not possess a reverse directory. If you don't know what that is, go away and look it up afterwards. Suffice to say, I had to discover legitimate ways of finding out the ex-directory phone numbers of famous and important people once I joined the Times. The life of a news journalist, the pressure you are under 24/7 to get the exclusive, is absolutely unimaginable, especially so in those days. And it is far worse on a Sunday than on a daily, believe me. I can hack on horseback with the best of the royals. But before this crisis, I would not have had a clue when it came to hacking a phone. I won't excuse my colleagues, but nor will I condemn them. I can understand why it happened. Our reaction to this crisis of ethics should not imperil the freedom of the press. And well done the Sun on printing those pictures of Harry. There is a strong ethical dimension to the hacking scandal, as I don't need to point out to you of all people. First and most obvious is the fraud that it entails. The hacker has no business in the private mailbox of another individual's phone and uses a shabby piece of ingenuity to enter it. It is e-burglary, plain and simple. Once the hacker's in, they set about stealing information to which they have no right. "Who steals my purse steals trash," writes Shakespeare in Othello. "'Twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed." Shakespeare, as ever, is on the money. The purse, compared to the good name, is valueless. Moreover, the theft of the well-deserved renown is of no use to the one who steals it, even though it impoverishes the victim. Shakespeare is surely hinting at crimes in the area we now call identity theft. The essence of the individual is being filched by an imposter. If Shakespeare were writing now, he would surely be deploring this sly entry into another man's organ of communication and the subsequent manipulation of it. Put these words of Shakespeare into the context of the play and you realise how ingenious he was being, for they happened to come from the mouth of his most chilling incarnation of evil, Iago. Not unlike the hackers, Iago behaved as he did because he could. Here is a piece of rank hypocrisy from a man whose own ambition is nothing less than the destruction of the one he purports to serve. Again, it's not hard to find a modern counterpart in the papers, which week after week write of moral superiority in their opinion columns, while being admired in their own corruption or bullying practices. Now, we in newspapers often complain that we get blamed for being the bearers of bad news. In other words, we are being made to suffer for the presence of some inconvenient truth. But once again, we find Shakespeare on the case. He was one of the first English writers to address the rather biblical concept of the messenger being shot for his bad tidings. The poor messenger who incurs Cleopatra's rage by telling her that Antony has married another woman pleads with her not to carry out her threat of cutting out his eyes for use as balls. "Gracious madam, I that do bring the news made not the match." Sophocles had already made the point in Antigone with the observation, "No one loves the messenger who brings bad news." For Freud, this punishing of the newsbringer was usually evidence of a potentate's anger at losing control and hence power. The messenger may not have been responsible for whatever catastrophe he was reporting, but he was tainted by the details he carried and was conveniently close at hand for punishment. We in the media are regularly denounced for being the bearers, for dwelling on bad news. Our accusers never seem appeased by the fact that a plane or train arriving without mishap at its destination is simply not a story. I always argue that the fact that news is so often bad augurs for a good creation. It means the norm, the dull quotidian norm, is good news. It has been hard for me, although I don't expect pity, chronicling an institution, the church, in chronic decline. I often get blamed. But do these detractors really imagine that if journalists wrote only positive things and neglected our public duty to report, for example, on paedophile priests or on the more difficult but still important phenomena of inadequate leadership that we see the fruits of in many institutions, do they imagine the decline would stop? It would not. But sales of our newspaper, which over the last few months have actually increased, would quickly hurtle us into extinction. Still, it is the case that we no longer enjoy the protection once given to our forerunner, the town crier. If you attacked the town crier for his unwelcome news, you could be charged with treason. We may not set out to tell parables, and yet this too is one of the functions we perform. The word parable carries the sense of analogy or comparison. And in bringing the stories to our readers of swindlers convicted, philanderers outed, tyrants brought low, newspapers are surely reciting the cautionary tales of rumblings, tumblings, and humblings for today's society. This role has never been more important than it is now, with systemic corruption eating at the bodies of democratic politics, law enforcement, money minding, and storytelling itself. We should be careful when we ask for gospel truth. There were four gospels, and while they agree on certain essential elements of Christ's life, they diverge on others. Strictly speaking, to be given the gospel truth is to be given a range of differing accounts. While we're on the Bible, you know that the only time the press is mentioned in the Bible is when the King James Version tells us Zacchaeus could not see Jesus because of the press. We are still there at the foot of the tree with the sinners such as Zacchaeus. Yes, we do deserve in much measure the ignominy. We became like one of our own stories. We got done for exposing ourselves in public. The world of Hackgate, when it was at its height, was surreal. Rumours became so rife that we heard our own coming back round again, altered and misquoted. We were our own sources, even though we weren't able to name ourselves. Hacking is an ugly word for an ugly activity, and it's hacked its way right into the heart of the vocabularies of our public and private lives. The practice has caused deep wounds, as if a liberal machete, an axe, has been swung with wild abandon into the informal, slowly developed systems of trust, which we like to detect in our social and political discourse. How has this happened? Where has it come from? Most pressingly, what are its implications for the future, now that the reputation of the press has been so damaged from within? Ugly, but interesting. We first come across this four-letter word in the literary context in 18th century London, when the hacks of Grub Street were jobbing journalists whose pen was always for hire. It would take more than two centuries for the word to acquire its modern meaning of gaining unauthorised access to someone else's computer or phone, yet there is a common root. It lies in Hackney and refers to the carriages of that district, which were likewise available for hire. As far back as 1300, it denoted the ordinary horse I spoke about earlier. Hackneyed meant then, as it still does, overworked. But when we now talk about celebrities' mobiles being hacked, we don't mean someone's taken an axe to them, however violent the intrusion might mean. We mean the information contained privately thereon has been made available for public, for general use. And suddenly details about, say, Prince William's knee injury are the common property of all who read a certain newspaper, or used to. Not only them, of course, but the rest of the world whose appetites are then further served by the rest of the media, passing on which is now in the public domain and by the Twitter sphere. So this is what we mean when we talk of hacking, even if it is not quite what we thought we meant. Usage has turned it into one of those words which try to soften the image of an activity, rather as liberate is used to try and soften the image of the word steal. It's all a bit of a laugh and we shouldn't get into a lather about it. Yet to hack is to deprivatise what was, is and should remain private, and as such can be seen as the theft of an important and increasingly threatened human right, whoever that human happens to be, the right we all have to personal privacy. It is, to use another hackneyed word, a minefield, and never more so than now. You may think it's a bit rich for a journalist such as myself to be so hot in the defence of privacy, when my profession has required such a bad reputation for the invasion of it. Moreover, countless newspaper editors, people who are not at all void of conscience and principle, state quite clearly that a good paper is one in which the people you are writing about would rather not be written about in that way. This logic runs right through a decent paper, cover to cover, from the relentless and commendable investigation by the Telegraph of MPs' fraudulent expenses, through the dismal reality of a much-heralded Hamlet, to the wrecking of a premiership derby through cynical fouls. These are not the pages, nor should they be, where you look in order to see bad behaviour whitewashed by a slick public relations machine, or mediocrities glorified by starstruck pushovers. Heaven knows there's enough of this going on as it is. For a paper with a serious, even moral agenda, which the News of the World claimed for itself, right through to the last day of its 150-year history, it obviously won't do. And so the guilty secrets and hypocrisies of the famous were fair game for a press which prided itself on its investigative history and could even claim to be a necessary adjunct of democracy. The weaker the voices of oppositional, whether from Parliament, the church or the trade union movement, the more valid such claims appeared. To understand the phenomenon of Hackgate and to prevent a recurrence, we need to know the background against which it grew. If you deplore what the tabloid press got up to in the name of disclosure, you called it sensationalism. If you approved of it, you accept that it dealt in matters of public interest, not just celebrity gossip, not just gossip which was merely of interest to the public or a section of it. Looking back to the years just before the millennium, we can see that the ingredients of a perfect storm were assembling and would continue to do so ever faster. First, newspaper circulation was going down and hasn't stopped, apart from on the Times, which is going up at the moment. For example, in 2000, the daily circulation of The Sun was 3.5 million. Today, that's down by nearly a third. Its main competitor, The Mirror, has seen its readership halved. The trend goes across the spectrum, with even The Telegraph plunging and The Guardian shedding tens of thousands. For the past 30 years, rumours of the demise of the British newspaper industry have been rife. Now it can seem they are well-founded, although actually I dispute that. The main reasons for this decline were linked ones of the internet's meteoric rise as a news medium and the loss of many readers in the under 35 age group as they switched to online. And that's where it's worth people such as yourselves looking at the newspaper industry, because of course we have that in common with the church, how to attract the young and keep them. As a result of the decline, advertising, which has traditionally financed newspapers, was slumping, and editorial staff came under increasing pressure to produce circulation-boosting scoops. One of the many sobering truths to emerge from the various inquiries into press practice is that newspaper journalists were less in competition with rival publications than with each other. From journalists assessed on the number of bylines they had in the paper over the course of a year, have we now gone to journalists being assessed by the number of followers we have on Twitter? I'm at Ruthie Gledhill, by the way. There were other pressures. Intrusive press methods used to capture images of Princess Diana enraged the public after her death in Paris in 1997. When she was apparently pursued by a posse of paparazzi on motorbikes. Under one of Fleet Street's periodic truces with Buckingham Palace, editors were asked to leave the young princes, William and Harry, alone, and they did so. In losing Diana, we lost a star. But did we then go on to try and plug the gap with the manufactured royalty of the Beckhams, the drama of such reality shows as Big Brother, the sad death of Jade Goody? By the middle of the noughties, phone hacking was, according to many journalists, widespread. One senior journalist said in an interview that loads of journalists were doing it and that Clive Goodman, the News of the World's royal reporter, had been made a scapegoat. By the end of the decade, the word endemic was being widely used to describe the practice. If that was indeed the case, it's not hard to see why it was so easy. Here's how it was done, or so I'm told. Newspapers have always kept their own directories of famous people's phone numbers, except for the Times. Armed with the digits, you called the person. Maybe they answered, or maybe they didn't. But while the call was in progress, another phone would be used to call the same number. During the automated response, you keyed in a numerical code which gave you access to the message system. These code settings were often obvious combinations, such as four zeros, having never been changed and personalized by the user. And even if that was not the case, it was still not difficult to find out the settings. These were the dark arts which enabled reporters to spy on the private lives of public figures. If you were in that area of journalism and you shunned such methods, you put yourself at a serious disadvantage, particularly if you were a freelance or on a short-term contract. One ex-employee of the News of the World claimed he had been actively encouraged to hack phones. He said in an interview, "It was always done in the language of, 'Why don't you practice some of your dark arts on this?' which was a metaphor for saying, 'Go and hack a phone.'" Such was the culture of intimidation and bullying that you would do it because you had to produce results. Ironically, in our pot hacking world, it is the celebrities themselves, so often the lifeblood and the victims of the red tops, who have led the charge against us as these crimes have been exposed. No lovies, these. They are powerful, highly articulate, and most importantly, outraged victims of intrusion and spokesmen of their trade, such as Hugh Grant, Steve Coogan, and Julie Walters. And if people such as Grant, Coogan, and Walters are now treated with caution, indeed fear of legal action, by the tabloids, does that really matter? Whatever the recommendations of Leveson following his marathon inquiry with 650 testimonies, it does look as though our relationship with the stars will undergo a shift. In the past, a kind of unspoken agreement has evolved whereby stars yield certain bits and pieces about their supposedly private lives in return for publicity for films, gigs, books, music, etc., even their restaurants. Some have traded grudgingly in this market, while others have been happy to flaunt this emotional release. For the second category, nothing need change, provided disclosures do not compromise the legitimate privacy of others. For the first, however, some sort of protection seems bound to come in, and enforcement will surely be a key. Andrew Knight, a senior lecturer at the London School of Journalism, says the Press Complaints Commission's Code of Conduct, which governs basic principles of journalistic behaviour, and which I was told at an ethics workshop only 2 weeks ago at the Times, must be part of my lifeblood, part of my continuing consciousness, governs basic principles of journalistic behaviour effectively. But Knight says one important issue to have emerged during the inquiry is why illegal and unethical practices were allowed to continue unhindered when editors and staff involved were fully aware of the law and the PCC's guidelines. How did that happen? There is already legislation in place which makes hacking illegal. This is the 2000 Regulation of Investigative Powers Act, under which such actions are a criminal offence unless undertaken by intelligence agencies or police. You could, perhaps we all could, be forgiven for missing it, since it was one of 3,000 pieces or thereabouts of legislation enacted by the Blair government. But there it is. And like Reaper, as it's known, hacking itself has been around for far longer than we tend to think. When the press engaged private investigators back in the old pre-mobile days, what do you think they got up to in order to learn the secrets of the stars? Where did reverse directories come from to those newspapers that had them? Did newspaper executives know how these were being obtained and used? Did they even care so long as they got the goods? Perhaps we should be told, although we never will. The fact is that in the noughties, this function was no longer carried out only by outside operatives, like the professional footballer turned private investigator Glenn Mulcair. One effect the technology of revolution was, and will remain, the accessibility of certain skills which were once the sole province of experts. Anyone could hack, and so, provided they had a moral code which could be overridden by the career imperative, they did. ethics dodged corporate scrutiny. They became privatized. Because of the continuing spread of social media and the rise of the citizen, a creature much derided by professionals, of course, the citizen journalist, ethics will probably remain privatized. And this is where you, the church of today, come in. The privatization of ethics. We might not be able to stop it, but theologically intelligent public witness is needed now more than ever to the importance of ethics and to understanding the consequences of their abandonment in the public square. Not just in dealing with the sins of us, the print media, but to help emerging generations cope with the fallout from new media. As Elizabeth Murdoch said in her MacTaggart lecture in Edinburgh earlier this week, we and all organisations, even the church, need to discuss, affirm and incorporate a rigorous set of values based on an explicit statement of purpose into our very corporate identity. It is already happening at News International. And because of what happened, because of what we did, we might even be ahead of the curve on this. Perhaps if this had happened in churches years ago, the sex crimes against children that we've read so much about might have been apprehended and stopped earlier. The other new impulse, which will almost certainly harden and deepen, is caution. We now live and continue to live, will certainly continue to live, with a certainty that was hitherto unknown and unthinkable. This certainty is that when you sit down at a screen, it is probably as well to assume that what you're about to write will in due course be read by any number of individuals who you don't know and whose mere existence you've never been aware of. It is not just that this hidden inspectorate will suddenly group up and pounce on your sentences, just that they might, for the simple reason that you've lost control of the destinations which your mail or your musing might just find your way to. This is surely another of the great ironies of the new settlement. There is a total mismatch between the speed with which you can rattle the words off into the computer and the eternity for which they will indelibly be stored. It is also a very thorough reversal of the historic picture, in which you could labour on a letter for hours with your quill and inkhorn, only for the thing to end up as kindling in the grate of some cold house in the country, spend weeks on a story about a papal encyclical, for it to be wrapping the notorious fish and chips just the following day. So what of us, the hacks ourselves, the messengers who found ourselves being shot? The first thing to say is that the whole of the industry has been chastened by the disclosures of Hackgate. And that is just as true of we supposedly good guys on the broadsheets, careful though we must be to resist any temptations of smug superiority, it's just as true of us as of the tabloid reporters. Now, News International employees are quite used to hearing our founder and boss, Rupert Murdoch, come under heavy attack. Not just from Guardian reading liberals, although they remain the most irritating, or should I say you, but from all manner of men and women who think they've found the font of all Philistinism in modern Britain. Well, they haven't. Although God only knows Murdoch has been a wonderful lightning conductor for them all these years, standing there and being randomly zapped by bolts of rage against Page 3, Soccer, Sky TV, America, Fox News, and much besides. He's an extraordinary complex force, deeply committed to newspapers at the time of their greatest insecurity. He's the last man standing and is probably likely to remain that thing in some form for as long as he lives. And believe you me, at the Times we pray that he lives an awfully long time. A legitimate fear now is that there is an authoritarian backlash which will draw the teeth of the British press and leave us with something bland, supine, and timid. Perhaps the fear is exaggerated in the wake of the shocks I've been describing. It would be wholly out of character, after all, for our print journalism, traditionally so much more feral and outspoken than our broadcast media, to roll over on our backs and accept regulation. At Leveson, it fell to a former Times journalist, the present Education Secretary, to spell out the dangers. A few slips in standards, argued Gove, were the necessary price for a precious freedom of speech. His cabinet colleague Ken Clark went further. Clark said there was no need to make investigative journalism subject to statutory controls. If we look at the affair's implications for future privacy, we find that once again the machinery is in place. UK judges have been eager to temper Article 10, the right to freedom of speech, of the Human Rights Convention with Article 8, which concerns the individual's right to privacy. It's even been argued that with super injunctions they veered too far the other way. But Hackgate came at a time when other British professions and institutions, not just ours, were under savage attack. Politicians had been discredited by the fiddling of expenses, and like the rogue journalists, MPs were doing it because they could, because a culture of impunity had become embedded in their workplace. Likewise, bankers, who seemed to have enriched themselves with credit default risks or gambled our money away in high street casinos marked as banks, and then got the taxpayer to make good their losses. The police, too, have come under scrutiny. Perhaps the only surprise is that the press took so long to come under this critical gaze. Too late? Emphatically not. Whatever happens to newspapers, any changes in the delicate balance between laws of freedom and privacy as a result of the hacking scandal must be relevant to the conduct of journalism in its myriad other outlets. Few industries have seen such a long twilight as that we are living through. Yet I still say that predictions of imminent nightfall are premature. Have we seen our greatest days? Maybe, maybe not. Yet even in these threatened days, we remain, or our newspapers remain important, dignified presences in our global landscape. Like the ice caps, which they might or might not outlive. Look what we've done to the ice caps and how we now regret it. So what is life like now in the newsrooms at News International as we await the outcome of Leveson? I would say we are indeed truly chastened. I don't want to trivialise a serious issue, but we are definitely on the naughty step. Every journalist I know in our company came into the profession because of an insatiable curiosity and a desire to know the truth and speak that truth to power. Some of us might have lost our way a little, some a lot. But now I would say we are back on track. My colleagues are highly intelligent, well-educated people. The young trainees and other young journalists coming through onto the Times are incredible in their abilities and intelligence. The pressure to go to unacceptable lengths to get stories, never a part of our culture in any case, has on other papers diminished, if not gone entirely. This will leave these fearless and motivated young journalists who still seem to want to work in newspapers that are the future of our profession, it will leave them free and unburdened as they must be to pursue truth. That will give rise to freedom of speech and information, which when combined with technology in the right way, means the future for journalistic inquiry is simply beyond exciting, beyond anything you can imagine. You should see, for example, what a Times journalist such as Tom Whipple can do, perfectly legally, with Excel. You wouldn't believe it. Who can decry what Kaya Burgess has achieved for thousands of cyclists in our Cycle Safe campaign, inspired by the terrible accident suffered by our colleague Mary Bowers, who's still in hospital? And the results being achieved from new ways of using social media led by Megan Locero. The extraordinary efforts of our Olympics production and reporting team at the Times. Even today, I am as excited by newspaper journalism and its future as Elizabeth Murdoch is by television. Leveson, I believe, will leave us free where we need to be free, with the right kinds of controls to ensure it does not happen again, however administered, and with a lesson well and truly learnt. So one day, I believe that everyone here, even here, and in the UK, will have cause to be grateful to our company and to the news of the world in particular. Like Elizabeth Murdoch, I'm optimistic about the future. Perversely, and we journalists are often perverse, I believe the crisis will have ushered in a new era where journalism is effective, professional, and relentless in its pursuit of the truth as never before. Perhaps it's too optimistic to imagine that the church and nation will ever have the grace actually to thank Rupert Murdoch. But you never know, do you? You just never know. Thank you. We've got 15 minutes to spare if anyone wants to ask some questions. Otherwise, at the last minute, I've been asked to do one of those talk slots at 11 o'clock tonight, where you're welcome to come along. And I've got some books and CDs which I can sell there if anybody's interested. Oh, if you want to ask a question, could you come to the mic, please?
Thank you. Thank you. You say that the journalists were aware that hacking was widespread in the industry, yet you were working for an organization that treated one journalist as just an odd exception and did its best to tie up Scotland Yard and threaten the politicians. Did you have a conscience yourself? Did you think of resigning or moving elsewhere to something nice and safe like the BBC?
I didn't say every journalist was aware hacking was widespread. What I meant to say, I'm sorry if I didn't make it clear, was that journalists in papers where hacking was widespread knew that it was widespread, or some journalists did. I suppose those who were doing it maybe knew or knew of it. Certainly I didn't know it was widespread. I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea how the news of the world got their stories. So I think it would be a mistake to resign from the Times when, as far as I'm aware, nothing has been proven about the Times' involvement in hacking of that nature.
So, as I understand it, I think it was The Guardian started talking about hacking 2-3 years before criminal convictions were finally brought. So if The Guardian failed to regulate the other press by bringing it to light, and the police failed, and the Independent Police Press Complaints Commission also failed, what sort of common controls do you think the Leveson inquiry can bring that trump all of these and will succeed where they failed in the past?
Well, I would dispute the fact that The Guardian has failed. I think it's been a resounding success, and Leveson was the fruits of that success. I think the danger of what The Guardian did is the threat to freedom of speech, which now imperils our industry. And I think that Leveson will produce a result, a good result. Obviously, controls are needed, and the nature of those controls are still to be determined. But I would dispute the use of the word failure, or I would not accept that it's all been a failure, because now we are seeing a result, aren't we? I mean, it takes hard work to get these kinds of things out.
So better late than never.
Better late than never, definitely.
You said that the press has now turned a corner and, you know, heralding a new era. But yet the other day, The Sun has published those photographs, claiming that it was in the public interest. What do you think about that?
Well, it's always a grey area, isn't it? The difference between what's in the public interest and what's in the interest of the public. And I think that one of the problems with Leveson was the fact that it focused so exclusively, as it had to, on newspapers, while around us is the rather wild west of the internet and the new social media. Now, anyone who looked, and I looked, and I admire anyone who resisted the temptation to look, on the internet could see those photographs of Prince Harry. So it's simply not fair or reasonable to expect a newspaper to resist publishing those when they're available freely on the internet. So if they want to stop publication of those pictures like that, first of all, they should get Harry to stop behaving like that. Secondly, they should try and do something about the internet, which, of course, is an impossible thing to do. So I think we have to accept the new Wild West that we're living in at the moment and find a way of dealing with it that doesn't involve shutting a stable door, you know, especially an Augean stable door where it's long ago been cleaned and the door is wide open. And yes, there might have been trouble there, but it's gone now. And really, no point attacking the sun over that. Problem lies far, far elsewhere.
But there's a lot of stuff on the internet, loads of stuff out there, which is very, it's terrible stuff, but it's not printed every day by the newspapers. So I'm not sure if it's a very strong argument that just because it's out there on the internet, the sun can just, you know, put it up there.
Well, it's about, there is lots of stuff out there on the internet. There you're talking about news values. What is a news story? And most of the stuff out there on the internet does not constitute what would be a news story in terms of the Sun's news agenda, whereas Prince Harry cavorting naked clearly does constitute a news story. So it's not because it's out there on the internet that they used it. It's for other reasons, but the fact that it is out there enabled its use.
Would it not seem that, I mean, you know, you have every few years, you have events like Hatgate coming along, you know, Princess Diana's death, where there's a sudden shock with the way the media behaves, and there's a sudden belief that the media should be reined in. And then after a period of a few, maybe months, maybe years, as with this, you will have the media being reined in, but then slowly it starts to build up again. I'm using a metaphor of a weed here, like you cut the weed down, but the roots still remain, and it still grows back up, even though weeds aren't very pleasant. But many people have kind of aired their concern that Leveson will not have that great an impact. Lord Justice Leveson himself said that he was worried it would be his book would remain on the second shelf of an academic's bookshelf. How do you see the effects of Leveson in the long term, and do you really believe that it will change, or do you believe we'll just get back to the same situation we were in the middle of the noughties?
I think that's a really important and astute question, and one that needs to be taken very seriously by our industry. Now, over my lifetime and before my lifetime, there have been many inquiries into the press, and the results of these inquiries have been precisely as Leveson fears. They have ended up on dusty shelves, and nothing's happened into them. I studied them when I was at journalism college. Now, but because I'm in the industry now, and I do believe this will be different, it seems to me from within the industry that there has been a sea change, a total change in the way our company is kind of incorporating its ethical identity. I mean, it's still a process. It's a process that's happening. So I can't... it sounds a bit woolly the way I'm describing it, but believe you me, from the inside, things are changing. And that's how change has to happen. You can't just impose change by statutory regulation. It has to happen from the very inside. Now, we've got a new breed of people coming up through the ranks of our executive leadership on newspapers. We've got a very young editor at the Times who has high standards of honesty and integrity. And we have extremely interesting, powerful, ethically orientated executives who endorse the Elizabeth Murdoch mantra that profit is good, but it must not be at the expense of everything else. You know, profit must have purpose as well. Now, I think that what we're seeing now, and Leveson has been the trigger of that, but we have to be responsible for enforcing it or enacting it, is the incorporation of purpose into the profit ethic, which kind of ruled the 80s and the subsequent fallout from the 80s into the 90s and the noughties, of which Hatgate was one consequence, one of many terrible consequences. So I think that you're right, and it's understandable that people will be cynical about our abilities to reform and to accept reform. But I really do believe that we are reforming. Now, when you talk about the weed and its roots, which I think of it as a cushion. You sit on the cushion and it pops up in another place, you know, in the cushion. You can never kind of get rid of the cushion. Well, I think that the problem is not with us now. We will be changed and made better, you know, made whole again, if you like. The problem is, as I said before, with the other manifestations of communication media, which are now becoming manifest, and those are the ones where attention needs to be focused in order to prevent similar things happening there in a few years hence.
It's a case of removing the plank from your own eye before taking the splinter out of another?
Yes, and that's what we're doing, you see, and that's what we failed to do for so many years. But I think the plank has been thoroughly shot away. Hopefully we're not blind now, though, as a result.
Would you like to comment on the morality of some investigative journalists who have brought the iniquities of somebody in public life to light by purporting to be other than they are, undercover investigators, for instance, attending an MP's surgery in order to record him saying something incriminating, and the person who has been found to have done something out of order is then castigated publicly for that. But the people who've obtained that information, the ethics of their behaviour seems to pass without challenge.
Well, the ethics of their behaviour doesn't pass without challenge. It is and was challenged repeatedly in many forums. However, the standard defence there is a public interest defence. And sometimes information that it is in the public interest to know can only be obtained using subterfuge. In fact, at the Times, we recently had an ethics workshop on precisely this matter. One of our journalists, in order to obtain information about illicit practices in the financial arena, had to assume a false identity. And if he hadn't done that, there's no way these institutions would have revealed the practices they were engaged in. But that story, when it was published, it made headlines all around the world and did bring about change for the better for the ordinary man and woman in terms of their finances.
So are you saying, really, in those cases, the end invariably justifies the means?
I don't say that. The law says that.
OK. I'll have a disagreement with the law, then.
Take it up with your MP.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question or offer a comment about your comments about public morality or ethics in the public sphere. Because it strikes me that the thing that's caused the most widespread disgust, actually, about Hackgate hasn't been people hacking the mobile phones of people who put themselves in public life and trade their private secrets for publicity. It's people hacking the mobile phone of Millie Dowler. And I'm not so much particularly interested in a comment about whether it's in the public interest about that, but about what you think that says about public ethics and about our shared public morality, that people would even think that that was a good way of selling newspapers.
I agree with you. I almost spoke about Millie Dowler, actually, in my speech, but then I decided not to because the messages, it's unclear. I don't think the messages were deleted by the journalists. It's not clear that and I realise you're not going to...
I'm not really interested in whether they were deleted by the journalists and whether they were... I'm interested in whether people... What you think it says about our public ethics, that people think that's even a good way of selling newspapers.
But you see, they don't think... They did think it was a good way of selling newspapers. I think if you ask the journalist... Well, I imagine, although I don't know, that if you ask the journalists who did that and that kind of thing, they would be saying, we were trying to help to find Millie Dowler. Now, no journalist that I know of would ever equate a journalistic practice with selling a newspaper. Nothing I do is in order to sell more copies of the Times. You know, the profit imperative is not kind of so immediate to our lives. I do what I do to please my news editor, to find out the truth about what's happening, to satisfy my own curiosity and in the out of public interest. You know, if there is an overriding ethic, it is the public interest, believe it or not. That really is the case. And even on, you know, on tabloid newspapers, it is the case. That's how journalists operate. So I agree with you. The Milly Dowler thing was, I was horrified by it. And as were so many people. But no one could see how that would turn out. And I truly believe that the people who did that had good intentions.
Okay. So it was a misjudgment.
I think it was a misjudgment, yes.
Thank you.
But it was, I agree, it was disgusting in the light of day, yeah.
Hi. You've covered this slightly in your answer about investigative journalism, but I was interested in your view on WikiLeaks and how the techniques used there compared to hacking, because I'd say it is a form of hacking. It's just that the recipients were not individuals having a conversation, they were governments who still thought they were having discussions in private. But obviously the debate may be finer in terms of the public interest. And so I'd just be interested in whether you thought discussions between governments should be subject to the same or different set of rules as those between individuals when they're considered to be private.
Yeah, you see, WikiLeaks, that's so interesting because this is exactly the kind of area that needs investigation and needs a Leveson-style inquiry to look at it, because what is happening here? I happen to know one of the diplomats whose messages were revealed, whose private conversations were revealed in WikiLeaks, and it was appalling. It was so appalling that a diplomat could not trust that his private conversations would not suddenly appear all over the internet. And I think when you get, you're really putting international governance at risk then. Really you are. And maybe people might say it's the exposures in WikiLeaks that heralded the Arab Spring and so forth, and that it helped to bring democracy in the Middle East, but it's not yet clear even whether we're actually getting democracy in the Middle East or quite what we're getting now as a result of the Arab Spring. And it gives me a lot of concern, and I think there is a lot of equivalence between WikiLeaks and the hacking saga as well, and that, yes, something needs to be done, but I think nobody knows quite what to do about it. It's like a huge monster, isn't it, that's out of control.
Yeah.
we can be controlled now with the press. The beast of the press, the feral beast of the press, is no longer what it was. You know, we're now on a chain, aren't we? Well, not quite, but we're more controllable. But no one even knows how to begin tackling this new monster that's grown up all around us.
Okay. Thanks. It's good to hear your view that is, in fact, a monster within the media and not seen as something that's kind of not as bad, but it's more that it's just so huge and difficult, it's less easy for one country to address.
I think so. See, WikiLeaks, if there's a public interest defence, it's fine. But when it's just a prurient defence, well, it's not fine, and I see no evidence that ethic was strictly in place in the whole WikiLeaks saga.
Thank you.
Okay, 5 minutes.
I'm a scientist, so I have an interest in statistics, and I heard what you said about journalists not being pushed by profit, but I'm yet to see a statistic in a newspaper that hasn't been twisted to make it sound more shocking and therefore twist the truth. Do you think while profit and selling newspapers, shocking headlines, are being the things motivating the people who are making the papers, maybe not the journalists, do you think while that's the case, there can ever be accurate stories that do tell the truth, or is there another way of doing it?
Well, I think that your language in terms of statistics in newspapers twisting the truth is rather emotive and biased against newspapers. And really, I would like to have this conversation with you subsequently, and I'd like you to produce for me a newspaper report with statistics where you can prove that a journalist has twisted the truth.
I have one from the Times that I looked up a couple of weeks ago that I can bring up. We probably don't have time now.
Okay, let's do it later then. But statistics, there's lies and statistics, I know all that. But statistics are there hard and fast. You know, they are legitimate things, and you can read them in different ways sometimes, but I wouldn't say it's twisting the truth. in the way that you present. You can, when I say read them in different ways, I mean, if you have, the statistics I'm always getting are the church membership statistics. Now, they tend to show a decline every year. So either you can report the decline, or you can report the increase, say, in baptisms. So you've got two lots of statistics there. Say there's an increase in baptisms in a year, that there's a decline in overall church attendance. Now, for many years, I would report the decline in church attendance because that was the most dramatic statistic. But more recently, I've started reporting the increases when I do the church stats story every year. And that's because the increases are now the more interesting statistic. But the church decline is still going on, but it's just rather boring now because it's been going on year after year after year. So if that's what you mean by twisting the truth, is it?
So if you were to find what you thought was the most truthful indicator of church attendance or church membership and were to publish that, would you see that as being more truthful than just finding what you see as being the most interesting?
It's not a question of the most truthful indicator, because in the Church of England statistics, they're all truthful indicators. There isn't a qualitative difference between them. They're all truthful indicators. So the only, I can't in a news story publish every statistics in a Church of England statistical report. There's thousands of them. So the only way of assessing which to publish is using the Times' news values to choose what is the most interesting. Now, I don't see that choosing something that's the most interesting can be equated with twisting the truth.
First of all, I would say I'm one of those who did not go and look for the Harry photo. I think that is not in the public interest. I think some journalists think it interests the public. But the point is, you had to go and look for that photo. But they did a mock-up, as I understand it, one day, and they printed the photo the next day. So on 2 days, you had what I would think of being inappropriate photographs. Bearing in mind where newspapers for sale are displayed, the photographs were at children's level. And I just think that's completely inappropriate, that that sort of rubbish is down where small children can see it.
But these are small children who have access, many of them, to their parents' computers and can get that information just by switching on the computer.
Well, that's a whole different issue about responsible parenting, isn't it? We don't have to actually put it out there so they have to see it. You know,
so
if they're in the newsagent, they see it. You know, if they're at home, they have to get through, presumably, not in every case, I'm well aware of that.
The Sun would not have published a picture of anybody else doing that, unless it, in the unlikely event that it was another royal. So do you have no judgment at all to make about the behaviour of Prince Harry?
I might think it's inappropriate, yes.
Irresponsible?
You could have reported that without the photograph, as other papers did. You did not have to have the photograph.
But pictures make stories. Pictures tell stories. It's a great picture.
No, I disagree. I disagree.
Also, there was nothing obscene in the photograph. I mean, you wouldn't know, as you say, you've not seen it.
No, I haven't seen it, but it's been reported, and I just think, you know...
But it wasn't obscene. I mean, those kinds of photographs are on display all the time in newspapers and magazines all around the world.
Well, that, again, may be an issue with what is or is not appropriate in terms of underwear advertising and all those sorts of posters.
I have to say that...
And that's a discussion that perhaps a wider society that doesn't want children to grow up too fast but is encouraging them to grow up too fast the whole time... Maybe that's a bigger discussion that we need to have.
Yes, well, pictures like that also appear in biology lessons for children, even in primary schools.
Again, do you think necessarily that children of 5 and 6 should be seeing that? And I might, not necessarily saying I am, I might say that that, again, is too much too soon.
Ruth, I want to ask you a philosophical and spiritual question about news reporting. You said earlier you had a choice of whether to report decline in attendance figures or rise in baptism figures. And you used the word, what was interesting about a story. Therefore, news reporting is not about reflecting society. It is, in a sense, about creating society. And the stories we choose to tell and pursue come from philosophical and spiritual perspectives that we've taken individually and collectively. I wonder if you want to comment about the spirituality of the times or the philosophy of it and where that comes from.
That's such an interesting question, which I haven't really got time to answer in full now. But certainly when you work for the times, you incorporate within you a set of instinctive values so that you're never told how to write a news story or what is the most interesting fact, because you instinctively know it, because it's the values of the times that you've kind of become aligned with. So it's a gut reaction as to what is the most interesting part of a news story. So those news values become part of your consciousness and the way you work. There are checks and balances to that. So, for example, most important news stories, you'll find the Telegraph, especially, but also the Guardian, the Mail, will have very similar lines on them. Most of the national newspapers will take a similar line in terms of simply reporting the facts. So there are objective news values beyond the organisation of the Times, which you can see reflected in the news stories as reported in all the newspapers. I suppose interesting is what's most important. And then if you get to most important, then you're getting back to the public interest again.
Well, I suppose I'd say that values sociologically are made by communities meeting together, making decisions, rehearsing what they share as their values. I wonder whether editors get together and they say, well, actually, this is what we're most interested in, and then they pass it on to you actually in meetings. So the nuts and bolts of how those values
Definitely. Every day there are two news conferences. Then there are leader conferences and feature conferences. And people do, they sit around the table and they discuss what are the most important stories of the day, where they should go on what we call the list, the schedule. And the first story at the top of the list will be the splash. So it determines everything. You know, from where a news story appears in the paper right down to... But the actual writing of the story, the journalist is responsible for that themselves. And that will rarely be altered.
So, last of all, I just wonder, when I read the Mail, which I try and avoid, it seems to me there is a spirituality of fear and suspicion about crime or about health. And I wonder, as a Christian, whether that's a false spirituality.
Sorry, say that again.
Well, I wonder whether Christians should critique the spirituality of certain newspapers because they are false. They create the impression that the world is a fearful place or an increasingly violent place. And maybe those are untrue spiritualities.
Well, I don't know. I think it would be criminal to pretend that this violence and crime doesn't exist and to cover it up and to give people a false illusion of safety. For example, where I live, in a nice area of southwest London, at the moment, on the loose, there are two people, a young man and a young woman, who at the end of last term were patrolling the schools looking for a child to abduct. And they actually tried to abduct at least one little boy as he was walking out of school on his own. And why did they choose our area? Because the children in our area are not streetwise, because they tend to go to private schools or very nice state schools, church schools, a lot of church schools in our area, and they are protected from the horrifying facts of life that children in other parts of London might be familiar with. So children in these abductors, potential abductors, would never go to these other parts of London because they know that they would not be able to abduct the children because the children have... that have a very strongly developed sense of self-preservation and an understanding of predators. Whereas in our area, they have this innocence and illusion of world being a nice, safe place, which I am taking everything I can do to preserve in my son for as long as possible. They live in that world. So, but when you're an adult, when you grow up, you have to know the truth about the world. And it would be criminal to tell people otherwise, that the world is not a nasty, dangerous, wicked place in more ways than any of us can imagine.